Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, brought to you from Hyatt Rickies in Palo Alto. I am Denise Carter, President of the Advisory Council of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, and your chair for this evening's program. We want to welcome the listeners of KAJX FM 91.5 in Aspen, Colorado, one of our more than 225 stations nationwide, joining us for America's longest-running radio program. We also want to invite all our listeners to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce to you Paul Saffo, Director of the Institute for the Future, who will be introducing our guest speakers. Mr. Saffo is a technology forecaster studying long-term information technology trends and their impact on business and society. His essays have appeared in numerous publications, including the Harvard Business Review, Wired Magazine, Civilization Magazine, the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, and Fortune Magazine, as well as other more specialized periodicals. Paul is the author of Dreams in Silicon Valley and The Road from Trinity. He was a 1997 McKinsey judge for the Harvard Business Review, and in the same year was named one of the 100 Global Leaders for Tomorrow by the World Economic Forum. Paul serves on a variety of boards and advisory panels, including the AT&T Technology Advisory Board, the World Economic Forum Global Issues Group, and the Stanford Law Advisory Council on Science, Technology, and Society. Paul holds degrees from Harvard College, Cambridge University, and Stanford University. The Institute for the Future is a 30-year-old foundation that provides strategic planning and forecasting services to major corporations and government agencies. Please welcome Paul Saffo.
Thank you, Denise. This is a special pleasure for me this evening to introduce this evening's speakers. But first, some history. In 1982, John Nesbitt published a little book called Megatrends, 10 New Directions Changing Our Lives. And change lives it did. It would go on to become a multiple bestseller. And as a real mark of success in my business forecasting, it was in print long beyond the period it forecast in, becoming something of a classic in the field. Now, most people would retire at this point, but not one to rest on his success, John went on to produce 9 more books, advise multiple companies, and in the process also carry a heavy teaching load at institutions from Harvard to Moscow State University and Nanjing University, where he is currently a professor. Too busy to graduate from high school and too eager to get out of Utah to remain, Don did go on, joined the Marines, and also picked up 12 honorary degrees in the process, and he's still going strong, as you see from the subject this evening. His co-author, Nana Nesbitt, is a writer, artist, and entrepreneur. She has advised companies ranging from Kellogg's and Spiegel to Motorola and Shell. She has an extraordinary flair for research, who also happens to be John's daughter, which is a good thing indeed, because if you knew John as well as I did, she's about the only person who is qualified to be the kind of adult supervision he needs to get out this book, which we have been so eagerly awaiting. And John and his daughter and their co-author have recently produced this marvelous new book, High Tech, High Touch, Technology and Our Search for Meaning. It is a wonderful global exploration and exposition of the challenges of technology affecting our lives today. So without any further ado, please join with me in welcoming John and Nana Nesbitt.
Thank you, Paul, and we are very, very happy to be here. The two questions that we get asked most about this book are, why did we write it, and what was it like working with your father or your daughter?
Well, we wrote the book because we believe that the merging of technology and culture is the essential societal dilemma of our time. Probably the most compelling question of the 21st century will be, what does it mean to be human? It's partly because of all of the technology we live with that this old question has a new urgency.
And it is our sincere hope that we stir a dialogue and reflective thinking about our relationship with technology in an age when it seems that there is no time to do so.
You know, it's one thing to share Thanksgiving dinner. It's another to share your work.
And my dad never pulled rank. And he tolerated a youthful idealism.
Tolerated.
of a young team, which includes our co-author Douglas Phillips and three researchers. He was incredibly open-minded and a very facile thinker, and it's been an incredible privilege to work with him.
Well, I didn't tolerate youthful idealism so much as I really celebrated it. I remember the three of us, had so many discussions about what we're doing. It went on and on, and there was kind of a experience gap because this was, you were right, Paul, I think it's the 10th book, and Nan and Doug had not written the book. And so my thought as we went along was, you know, at some point we have to put something on paper, just an idea. But I went along with the process. I yielded to the process, and I really began to trust the process. And I think that the result is certainly a much better book than I could have done myself. Now, all of us know that our children are smart, but to experience Nana's intelligence every day, day after day, was really a wonderful experience.
And I also brought my own kids into the process, and their thoughts and ideas sprinkle this book too.
Go ahead.
I just thought we'd start.
We're living in a technologically intoxicated zone. We Americans.
Or you could say we discovered it.
Yes, or it revealed itself to us. Marshall McLuhan was very fond of saying that he didn't know who discovered water, but he was sure it wasn't a fish. And similarly, we are inside this technologically intoxicated zone, and we really don't know that. We don't really understand that as we go on with our lives moment to moment and day to day.
But some of the conditions of that zone are that we are softened by the comforts technology brings to our lives. We're reliant on its constant companionship. We're addicted to its steady delivery of entertainment. We're awed by its power and speed, and we're seduced by its promises. Technology feeds our pleasure centers physically and mentally, but it is squeezing out our human spirit and intensifying our search for meaning.
Indeed, the subtitle of High Tech, High Touch is Technology and Our Search for Meaning. Intoxicated, we turn our back to technology's consequences, but it's squeezing our spirit, and that intensifies this search for meaning.
And technology's promises are music to our ears.
Technology is going to make us smarter, prettier, better, promises to be cheaper, faster, and easier than anything comes before, promises to connect us to the world and to keep us close. Promises to be the basis of new world economy and the great equalizer, and it promises to make us rich. particularly in this valley, I guess. Now we discovered, or the symptoms were revealed to us, the symptoms of living in a technologically intoxicated zone. The first symptom of that is that we favor the quick fix from religion to nutrition.
And technology really conditions us to want something solved immediately. And we have an array of quick fix solutions that are delivered through our information technologies on such fundamental questions as how to pick a mate, how to be happy in 8 minutes, how to date out of your league. It also delivers step-by-step programs, 7 secrets to hot sex, 4 marriage savers, 8 signs it's over. We expect instant relief from a pill. Viagra broke all records and did $1 billion its first year. Americans spend $85 billion a year on drugs in a world market of 180. We often turn to cosmetic surgery. We look to nutritional supplements and spiritual supplements, which are big business, from soul books, primetime religious shows, relaxation tapes, to all kinds of pills. The second symptom is that we fear and worship technology. The first Armageddon, 1,000 years ago, we feared God's wrath raining destruction upon the earth. Today that Armageddon is called Y2K. Airplanes will fall out of the sky, the global economy will come crashing to a halt. I've heard ads for radios that are, I can't remember exactly how it goes, but they said, we're going to need food and water and our product for 1995. Ted Kaczynski is probably the most extreme warner about the hazards of modern technology, and which he says diminishes our ancient quest for food, clothing, and shelter. There are also psychologists like Jane Healy who warns of extended computer use for small children, suggesting it may cause a pandemic of attention deficit disorder.
I've asked often about Y2K and what's going to happen. I think it may be quite a non-event. I think there's quite a bit of hype about it, but I do... What causes me to pause sometime is when I recall that after Y1K came the Dark Ages. We worship technology. Internet in every classroom, a computer in every classroom. And I don't think we really think that through. It's become kind of an icon. And we don't think through what computers will contribute to the education of children. I think the purpose of education is to, at any level, is to learn how to learn, and how the computers can teach us to learn how to learn, we haven't even asked. People say, well, we ought to have a computer in every classroom, and I agree with that, but I think we ought to think it through. But I also think we ought to have a poet in every classroom. And so my metaphor is a poet and a computer in every classroom. But I think in America we're spending our time and energy more on the computer than on the poet. And indeed, we are kind of robbing from the poet from our art classes, our music, and so on to put it on the computer. And I think that we've sometimes done that rather mindlessly, and we really ought to think about it. On the worship further of technology, we think that genetic modified products, agricultural products, will save us from starvation. Genetic engineering will eradicate disease. 1 minute we're being afraid of being left behind, and another that technology is going to save us. What this book is about, really, is about our relationship to technology. And that's a pretty unexamined relationship. And sometimes it's a dysfunctional relationship. And what we became very clear about, the three of us as we developed this book, was that technology is not neutral. It embodies today consequences, both good and bad.
The third symptom that we discovered was that we blur the distinction between real and fake. In a time when technology can transform nature as never before, it is no wonder that we ask, is that real? Is that fake? Is it authentic or simulated, genuine or imitation, original or copy? In a time when technology can create the surrogate, the ersatz, the virtual, the cyber, it is no wonder that we are obsessed with what is real and what is fake. And that confusion seems to exist most in the screens that pervade our lives. We as a culture tend to look at those screens as unreal, as benign, and even as educational. And those screens are flat, and they glow blue. The medium is compelling, whether the story is or not. We go into them, we get sucked into dizzying electronic games and movies, and we get spit out happier, more in love, sadder, or more pumped than when we went in. And yet we insist that they are not real. The number one entertainment in America today is media, and the number one content is violence. And the consequences of those screens are very real indeed.
The fourth symptom of being in a technologically intoxicated zone is that we accept violence as normal. I don't think that we really realize what a cultural of violence the United States is. And it's like, you know, the fish never discovering water. It's sometimes clear to people who are far away. I spent a lot of time in Asia, and a lot of Asians with that perspective of distance see very clearly how much violence there is in this culture, something that surely we have to attend to.
The fifth symptom is that we love technology as toy. America's affluence finances our play. And in a recent poll, Americans listed having fun as the most important thing in their lives, secondly, getting organized, and third, losing weight.
Getting organized is now number two? Tells you something.
When did that happen?
But in America, leisure tends towards diversion, like watching so many movies, as if we have nothing better to do with our time. And trying to relax in America is like trying to take a nap in a video arcade. And it's not surprising to us that MIT's new partners include MIT's Media Lab's new partners include Hasbro, Toys R Us, Lego, Disney, and Mattel. Nicholas Hayek, the CEO of Swatch Company, told us that if you marry the imagination of a six-year-old with powerful new technologies, you can create miracles. And we believe that cars are kind of a good example of this. They have shifted from being a luxury to a necessity to a toy, as most of our consumer technologies have. When cars first came out, they were an enviable luxury. And by the 50s, when America was mobile, they became a necessity. But today, we buy cars as toys. The Volkswagen Beetle for nostalgia, a Humvee for attention, a smart car for fun, or an Isuzu because it looks like a gym shoe. And with Motorola's talkabouts, you can pretend that you're playing, you can relive the days of playing I Spy with a crackly walkie-talkie. But today, the communication system's far better, and the colors are much more delightful. And where do we shop for these toys? Places like Mall of America, that's motto is, it's time to put fun in your life. Cities like Chicago with their Ferris wheels and riverboats and their loop motto is live, work, play. Or stores like REI in Seattle, where you can really relive the days of nursery school or Nike or American Girl.
The sixth symptom is that we live our lives distanced and distracted. The British artist Damien Hirst, his book title, I Want to Spend the Rest of My Life Everywhere with Everyone, One-to-One, Always, Forever, Now, is kind of a perfect metaphor for the Internet. Technology distracts us with its promise to document, distracts with its promise to entertain, distances with its promise to connect. Not many days ago, I was in Logan Airport in a public area where people were waiting for their flights, and there was a young family there, a mother and a father and two little kids, and the father looked sort of totally bored with the situation, and then his cell phone went off, and he straightened up, and he lit up like a Christmas tree, and hello. And I realized, and just sort of gestalted on this, that I realized that this guy was being rescued from his family responsibilities right out in front of him. And I thought, gee, I bet there are all kinds of guys, tons of guys, mostly guys, all over this country who are rescued by this technology, who are entertained by this technology. I don't know if it's commentary. If it is widespread, if it's a commentary on family life in America or on the technology or on some kind of mixture of the two.
This book is divided into two parts. The first part is today, and the second part, curiously enough, is tomorrow. And the first half of the book, we look at consumer technologies, which is really anything that you put into your house or your garage, and the effect that that has on how we live in time, how it really collapses and crunches our sense of time, and also on the effect that it has on how our children play, particularly electronic media. In the second half of the book, we look at genetic technologies that are emerging and try to understand them through a human lens of religion and art.
We looked at all kinds of of these technologies, the space technology as well as manufacturing technology and consumer technology. We spent quite a bit of time on consumer technology, and we discovered that the two biggest markets in this more than $10 trillion this almost $10 trillion U.S. economy, the two biggest markets are, one, consumer technology, and two, the escape from consumer technology. Which often the biggest venue there is travel and tourism. What we have when we see all this consumer technology and all the computer companies and software companies and so on, I'm always reminded of what happened early on in this century when we were moving into the automobile industry and creating an automobile industry. And we were trying to figure out what an automobile was and what the fuel would be and how big it would be and how many people it would carry, and then later on if people would buy a replacement and so on. And during that shakeout period, as we tried to figure out what a car was, we had in the United States more than 2,400. We went through more than 2,400 automobile companies. Now, today, the character and nature of our digital economy is quite different, and we'll probably end up with maybe 10,000 companies instead of three automobile companies that we have today out of those 2,400. We may end up with thousands, but we'll go through hundreds of thousands to get there. We have a chapter, the second chapter is called Military Nintendo Complex, of course echoing Eisenhower's warning about the military-industrial complex. And what we mean by this is the joint ventures of the military and the entertainment industry in creating electronic games that train both our soldiers and our children to kill people. And these are the same games. These are horrific games. and they do just that. And we saw the games, we saw the advertisements in children's magazines for the games, and it's such an institutionalization of violence and killing that I think we got to really pay more attention to that. And there was a survey just the other day that the electronic game Doom is one of the worst in training children to kill people. And 95% of parents didn't know what Doom was, but 75% of children did know what Doom was.
And we really believe that electronic violence is poisoning the souls of our children. But we are not Luddites, and we are not suggesting that there isn't positive applications to these very same technologies, which are being used precisely because they are so effective in causing change in hospitals around the country. And they're being used to treat phobic patients to get over their fear of heights. They're being used to help Vietnam vets get over their nightmares. They're being used in a program called Starbright that General Schwarzkopf is helping to institutionalize that connects terminally ill children with each other. And we just believe that we need to protect our children as a special brand of consumer from media violence in exactly the same way that we protect them from tobacco and alcohol.
When most people think about technology, they sort of think about the hard technologies, computers, telecoms, and so forth. But in the meantime, on the outside are coming what we might call the soft biological technologies of genetic engineering. And the importance of those technologies, we think, will totally overshadow the importance of the technologies that came before. We speak of the information revolution, and it's not so much a revolution. It's not much of a revolution because what the information revolution does, including the Internet, is to help us do what we're already doing faster, better, and hopefully more efficiently. But with genetic engineering, we will be able to be in charge of our own human evolution, because with germline engineering, we can change the genetic code, and those changes will be passed on generation to generation. And that will dominate the next century, which is just weeks away, of course. It's not so much a century of biology as it's more focused to a century of genetic engineering. There's much more to be said about that. But we interviewed scores and dozens of theologians and spiritual leaders about this, because most of it's focused on the science. And the names of Galileo and Darwin kept coming up, and we think this is now just such a time with the confrontation between science and religion, and whatever religion stands for, sort of our humanness in some ways, in many ways, and now we have the DNA, and it's going to be just as big. This is just such a time, and so this chapter is about the legacy from Galileo to Darwin to DNA.
And we spoke with the theologians because we felt that it's very, very, very important to set a context for understanding the consequences of these emerging technologies. And they offer something the scientists don't. And they offer a context which really focuses on who are we, who do we want to become, and how ought we to get there. And then more specifically, they raise concerns such as removing sex from procreation, the value of the uniqueness of each individual, the problems with the ideas of genetic determinism, that genetics cause us to be religious, or that genetics cause us to be have a propensity for alcoholism or to be obese, or all the many markers that they're discovering or believe they're discovering, and that the theologians suggest that genetic determinism really cuts the thread of ethics and morality. They address questions of playing God, really suggesting that that whole notion is giving God far too little credit and technology far too much.
The the trouble with thinking about and dealing with genetic engineering and germline engineering is that there's so much good news, but also so much mischief. We can, with germline engineering, eliminate over time terrible diseases like Alzheimer's disease and Down syndrome, sickle cell anemia, Parkinson's disease, and so forth, because with germline engineering, you change the code, you correct the misspellings in the code, and then they're passed on from generation to generation. However, and most people support that kind of germline therapy. However, the very same technology can be used for cosmetic enhancement to make people taller and smarter and, you know, to create and to perfect the human being. In short, this falls under the long shadow of eugenics. And Arthur Kaplan, the sort of preeminent bioethicist in the country these days, said something to us that was really pretty chilling. He said, "I think Hitler was hindered by not having the science. But look out, world, the science is coming."
And Donald Shriver, one of the theologians we spoke with, who is a professor emeritus from Columbia University in New York, suggests that beyond enhancements of beauty or sex appeal, he cautions that we also place too much emphasis on intelligence. And I quote him, "I don't think intelligence is the one authentic mark of human beings. There's also goodness. Plato talks about the good, the pure, and the beautiful. The human capacity to love is at least as impressive as the human capacity to know."
Germline engineering has to do with shifting from creating human beings in the image of God to creating human beings in the image of man, or how man thinks they ought to be perfected. Also, in the 1960s, gave us sex without making babies, and now in our brave new world, we can make babies without sex.
And we can go back to telling our kids about the stork. But one of the more serious contexts that the religious leaders also bring up is about human suffering. And they basically point to the premise in science that human suffering is to be eradicated. And one Islamic scholar that we spoke to, Abdulaziz Saqadina, I also would like to quote him. "We have lost touch with suffering as being educational, as being purposeful, as being something that reminds us of our fragility, our humanity, our ephemeral nature. The pain that we are trying to control through these sciences, the suffering that we are trying to control, the aging process that we are trying to control are beyond our control, and they are not evil. Secularist culture seems to be pushing us to conquer suffering as an evil, but they are reminders. They are some kind of divine celestial intervention. Human materialistic and consumeristic concerns are dragging us to believe that we can really overcome pain and suffering."
On that note, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, John and Nana Naisbitt, for your thought-provoking remarks this evening. We can't let you go yet. I've got a huge stack of questions here. I think you may be here for about 2 hours, and of course, we'd like you to sign some books. Speaking from here in Palo Alto, the world center of the technologically intoxicated zone, I want to exercise the moderator's privilege to open, not with a question, but with an observation. Actually, it's an observation posed as a question, and they have a plea for help at the end. "I'm trying to unwire my home. My children are addicted. We haven't watched TV for years. I disconnected our internet service provider this fall. When I took my son's computer away a few weeks ago, he wasn't doing his homework, I found he had gone up to the attic and brought down a toddler's computer game to play. Is there any hope? please send a repair manual. Your advice?
Well, you want you to take that because you did this.
I empathize. And this past summer, actually about a year ago, when we were doing the research for the military Nintendo complex, I would frequently find my children watching such shows as Celebrity Deathmatch, and I would immediately come and change the channel and turn it off, and they would exclaim that it's only clay. And after we battled this out a little while, one night they came to me and they were sobbing, my 13-year-old, my 10-year-old, and 8-year-old, that I was crazy and that this book was a big pain, and they wished I'd never started it. And so, and that TV was only TV, and it wasn't affecting them. And so the next day, I got rid of the TV altogether. And about 2 months later, I had the courage to ask them if they thought life was better. And each of them said yes. And our evenings pass so peacefully. We linger over dinner, which I now actually cook. And they drift to bed when they get tired. And they read. And the violin lesson doesn't, the practice doesn't stop at a half an hour. It goes on for an hour and a half. My son does math problems because he thinks it's fun. And my oldest boy and my youngest boy get into spontaneous games of name the state capitals. I mean, I sometimes wonder what decade I'm living in. I encourage you to unplug your TV. Life is so much better without it.
And besides Doom, what's your favorite video game?
Armageddon.
Another question from the audience. You're professional writers. You make your living on media. You're also professional media watchers. What do you think is going to happen to traditional print media, books and newspaper, in a moment in time when there is such an emphasis on the internet with quick turnarounds and quick answers?
Well, usually this is put in the form of either or. You know, it's we used to get our news and information from newspapers, and now we're going to do it electronically. And I don't think that's going to happen at all, no more than in retailing. We're all going to do it online. I think the mix will change. The trick is to decide how many people will give up newspapers and just get electronically. Some will do both, of course. But to look in the changes in the mix, and I don't think newspapers are going away. Marshall McLuhan, quoting Marshall McLuhan again, but he said, you know, reading your favorite newspaper is like taking a warm bath. And it is sort of like that. And you don't get that feeling when you get your news or your information, at least I don't, electronically. And I mentioned online retailing. The retailers are almost paralyzed with fear that everyone's going to order everything online. Well, retailing and going to the stores, and they're making it an experience now because you can't get that the kind of experience you can't get on the ordering online. And I think the mix is going to change. And my advice to retailers is to sell their stuff online as well. You've got to do that, but also continue to make the shopping experience a really social experience. So in most of these things, I think the first thing you have to say is not either or. It's not that one is going away because we got something new, but to try to, I don't know what you think about this, Paul, but try to get a sense of what the new mix is going to be.
I'm not sure I'm allowed to answer questions.
Oh, I'm sure you are.
Nothing new ever displaces the old, but the old thing reinvents itself. And my fear about newspapers is people will still want to read, but advertisers won't want to pay the bill.
Oh.
So we may end up with a gap where readers want to read, publishers want to publish, and nobody can afford it, and so we'll have to settle for internet and laser printers.
Hmm. But interesting point.
We're talking about, we've sort of flirted with the subject of education here. And I want to explore this a little bit, but we'll start with a very pragmatic question. From someone who apparently isn't working at a dot-com company and hasn't gone public. Will technology drive down the cost of a college education in the future?
Yes, I think it will. I'm a recent convert to distant learning, I must say. But I think it has to be high-tech, high-touch. One of the models I'm working on is in connection with my students at Nanjing University in China. And with things like PictureTel, which are digital to digital pictures and voice, and it's the quality is so good, and there's a kind of intimacy there that I think distant learning will work. And Oxford just announced that they're going to have you can get a degree without ever going to Oxford. So, and I think that we'll see the day pretty soon, maybe, when some famous professors will leave their tenured positions at universities and teach on the internet. And there's going to be tremendous competition, and that's going to drive down the price. What I worry about in education is more is children and computers, for example, and unintended consequences. You know, what I'm worried about right now is that we have little kids, 8, 9, 10 years old, who are writing reports for their classes on computers where they have spell check and grammar check. And you remember what happened when we got the calculators. I mean, no one learned their multiplication tables. And are we going to have generations of kids coming along who don't know how to spell or scandalously don't know the grammar of their mother tongue? It's just something we ought to think about. And we, again, our plea is to be more reflective and thoughtful about technology and how it fits into our lives instead of thinking we've got to get it, we've got to get the next upgrade and so on.
Well, I know you're a fan of distant education, but just you can put this into the next edition of your book as proof that technology does have a dark side. Here in California, we just started an online law school. So you can go to law school entirely in cyberspace.
Oh, dear. More lawyers.
In cyberspace, no one can hear you sue. But, John, you've spent a lot of time at the Academy. What do you think are the deeper changes? My sense of distance education right now is still a little bit of old wine in new bottles. How is it going to change the structure of the actual process of education?
Well, I think that you don't have to go to site-specific, you know, everything that we say, but I think there's – I didn't used to think this, but I think there is something to be said for experiencing teachers that you just otherwise would never, never have a chance to experience. And you can be in the most remote part of the world and still have a lecture from a world-class teacher and also have a dialogue with a world-class teacher. Now, that's, it seems to me, is kind of a basic sharing of information and ideas at a level that we really haven't had before.
So a new form of mentoring, in a way.
Yes, yes.
The next question, I will, if this question had a title, it might be Technology, Threat, or Menace? But with a hopeful ending. Do you feel that there is something in the human psyche that will eventually correct the one-sided development induced by the technology that inundates us?
Yes. We believe in the human spirit.
You know, and the human spirit is going to become more and more important because in what our soul is and our spirit, because when the scientists, you know, continue to break the code and have and know how we're all put together, and they won't have broken the code on what our soul is and how that's put together. And so I think that's we're going to hold on to that a little more and be even more interested than we've been interested in it in California. the more we know about the physical makeup of our bodies.
As you were writing this book and you were crisscrossing the planet, asking questions, exploring the topics that you discovered, what was the biggest surprise the two of you encountered?
What was the biggest surprise? Well, the most revealing thing was when we really dawned on us. You know, everyone says, well, technology is neutral after all. It depends on what people do with technology. And slowly, slowly, we decided that technology is not neutral, that there, as we said earlier, there are consequences. Especially with the electronic games and how they poison the souls of our children. Technology is not, much technology is neutral, but we can no longer generalize that technology is not neutral. There are consequences.
I think the other thing I would say personally, I agree with John, but personally the biggest surprise for me was was speaking with the theologians. I had been raised agnostic. and was absolutely amazed at what a pleasure it was, and how much love they had, and that the things that they spoke about were so fundamental and so good and so important, and that I think as a society we can't forget to include theologians from all faiths in debates about technology and technology's consequences. And, in the medical sciences, we've turned to bioethicists, or we've created a field called bioethics. They tend to be more concerned with the legal and procedural problems of medicine. The theologians add yet again another layer, and an increasingly more important one, as these new genetic technologies really affect our humanity. They affect what it means to be human and have the potential to actually change that.
I'm not on the brink of returning to Mormonism, but but I can say that I too was very, very impressed with the theologians, especially the theologians that we talked to.
And yet, when you were speaking, you talked about a coming confrontation between science and religion. Can you say a little more about what the shape of that might be?
Go ahead.
Well, one of the things that we noticed, as John said earlier, about this pattern of Galileo to Darwin to DNA, and that Galileo's insistence of a heliocentric universe really upset their religious apple cart, as did Darwin's theory of creation. And this mapping of the human genome, which the science increasingly tells us that everything that we are about, our behavior, the way we look, our propensity to be religious, is determined by our genes. And that's coming head-to-head with what religion tells us. And the sciences are even saying, you know, that a certain gene or certain chemical makeup can make one more religious or less religious. And that's where the theologians are really turning in and looking at, what does faith mean? What are our souls? What does the human spirit really mean?
One takes hope from the fact that occasionally science has been wrong. in this coming confrontation, what do you think the specific role of organized religion will be in this technocentric world?
Well, I think that should be a larger question, Paul. It's what are we all going to do? What we plead for is dialogue, that the wisdom is in the dialogue, and that we're not really talking about it. You know, we really haven't talked very much about the current technologies in medicine. You know, who gets the kidneys and who gets the livers and all of those new ethical questions. And we certainly haven't been talking about questions that are going to be raised and are being raised about genetic engineering. The Europeans are quite upset about, many Europeans are quite upset about genetically modifying agricultural products. When it really dawns on them that we've already started down the path of genetically modifying human beings, you can imagine the response. But we have to really talk about, there's only been one, as far as we know, one really open meeting where scientists and theologians and just walking around people got together to talk about germline engineering, and that was the meeting in UCLA March before last. But we really have to all talk, including the scientists and theologians, and because our lives are going to be affected, and the lives of our children are going to be affected by these new technologies.
There have been a number of questions about video, and of course you talked a lot about that, and we've talked about dialogue. A question from the audience was, the chapter on the effect of violent video on young people was extremely powerful. How can we get this information out to other parents?
It's interesting. Do you know John Cotter of the Harvard Business School? John, who's a neighbor of mine in my place in Cambridge, read the book, and he, as a parent, he has two young children, 8 and 11, and he, on that chapter that's referred to, he thought that that we ought to take that chapter out, sort of enlarge the print in order to enlarge the number of pages, and really package that as something for parents to take a look at, because evidently parents are not paying too much attention, and people don't really realize how powerful these things are and how addicted children are to them. And the people that make these games feed the addiction. I mean, they understand totally that the kids are addicted to this violence. So as with any addiction, they have to increase the dosage. So they ratchet up the violence and the realism of the violence. And we interviewed these young, mostly men, some women, in their 20s who make these games and program these games. And they were very open. They were even cavalier about how they're making them more and more violent. Then Littleton came along, and they're all lying low, and three of them got in touch with us and said, hey, don't use our quotes. And we said, well, it's a little late for that. and they are in the book, of course.
What other ideas do you have to help protect our children from the negative aspects of technology, given that there are other forces in the marketplace? There's the busy schedules of parents and also our society's emphasis on the value of free speech.
We agree with the problem of free speech, and it's very tough in America to begin any sort of censorship, though there are people who believe that Americans are getting to the point where they're going to tolerate some censorship. However, we believe that there's basically a three-tiered approach: education, litigation, and legislation. Media literacy should be taught in our schools as children increasingly turn away from reading towards electronic media. Legislation's already begun. We believe that the entertainment industry is going to become socially and fiscally accountable for their product in exactly the same way that the cigarette companies have become responsible. They are already being sued for victims of copycat murders. We do believe that Littleton is a watershed event. The gun manufacturers are already taking a protective stance. And so that's basically what we believe can be done.
Let me just add, Paul, on the free speech, because a lot of people hide behind free speech in making these outrageous and horrific games, and the movie industry as well. And I've always, you know, been ready to put my body on the line for free speech. But we've made exceptions, and there's the famous one that's been in place for decades now, of that free speech does not include, the Supreme Court said, falsely crying fire in a crowded theater. Well, we believe that these electronic games are poisoning the souls of our children, and that this is crying fire in a crowded theater, and that we can make an exception here along the lines of this previous exception that we've made to free speech.
Currently, the rating system of video games and film has no legal teeth. Any retailer can sell any game to any child. Any child can go into any movie.
Now, this is a very serious question. Did you find a video game you liked?
No. I personally don't like video games. I find the whole act of sitting in front of the screen and pressing a button, or the argument that somehow this is training our kids with really good eye-hand coordination, you're a little ridiculous.
Yeah, tennis does the same thing.
Now, 100 years ago, parents were alarmed that their children were reading penny dreadfuls and cheap novels.
They should have been.
Yes, look where
look what it started.
It started there, and it's ended at video games. There's nowhere to go but then slippery slope. I mean, is this something that video games as a medium will pass through? Can it be reformed? Can video games become more positive?
Well, you know, I don't know. But, you know, we've moved because, you know, video games, the sale of video games is more than twice the sale of movies. Tickets and buying of video, movie videos. It's now a $16 billion a year industry. And the films is, this year is about $14 billion, the highest it's ever been. You know, there's just a tremendous demand for this as the addiction goes up and the addiction is fed.
And kids are really attracted to this sort of particular stimulus, and they are riveted to it, and they fight to get on the games. A friend of mine in Telluride told me that her two boys were driving her crazy, her 9-year-old and her 6-year-old, because they were fighting over this game, Zelda. And I asked her if she were interested in reading our chapter, which was a work in progress at the time, and she said, oh, yes, yes, give it to me. So she read it, and she and her husband decided to give away, throw away the Nintendo set and all of the games. What she hadn't realized was that besides enjoying the benefit of not having to referee her kids fighting, was that her 9-year-old's nightmares went away, and her 6-year-old son stopped compulsively chewing his shirts, because these games simulate a stressful job, and it's they are stressful whether they are violent or not.
And I would say, building on your Penny Dreadfuls, that it's technology that has made whatever is conveyed so much more powerful. And it differs today, differs from those earlier days, because today we witness children killing children in schoolyards.
And the technology itself amplifies and magnifies whatever came before in the form of a book or a comic. And the aim of the entertainment industry is ever, ever more realism. And soon you'll be able to feel as well as hear, as well as see something the size of a movie screen with a pair of goggles. And these technologies deliver a steady daily diet of this stressful, often violent content. That's new.
We're running our clock down, but I want to just squeeze in two more questions. There's so many areas we haven't talked about. One of them, they have several questions here, is the future of the environment and its interaction with technology. Will technology save us from today's environmental follies, is one questioner asks.
That was the one chapter we wanted to do, but we didn't do.
Well, I think it will, Paul. That's been the history of civilization, and I think so. I think that we have some more serious immediate problems today.
Well, this is one of these areas where father and daughter tend to disagree.
Tell us more.
Well, in doing this book, the three of us we sometimes talked for days and trying to jointly figure out what was going on, and we differed a lot. We changed a lot in the process. I remember at one point thinking, hey, you guys, somewhere along the way we have to really start putting something on paper. It's just this idea. But
which we resisted vehemently for months.
But we didn't get to our chapter on environment.
Well, the next edition. I think we have time for one last question. And as you were doing this book, what did you encounter that gave you the greatest hope that things will turn out well?
I think children teaching children. There are a number of bottom-up initiatives around the country where children are getting organized and exercised about media violence. And I have a lot of faith in this bottom-up. During my lifetime, for example, cigarette smoking has gone from being a very glamorous thing to do to being pretty much socially unacceptable. And that was not top-down. It was not legislated. It really is happened over the years by people doing something about it. Did you want to add?
Would you like no. The last word?
The last word,
Nana. The last word. The more we got depressed about the state of our society in recognizing this in this technologically intoxicated zone. On the other side of that, we started to see real glimmers of hopeful change. And the Littleton event really has been a watershed event, and we believe that America has begun to reverse the culture of violence.
Thank you very much.
Our thanks again to our speakers, John Nasbitt and his daughter, Nana Nasbitt, authors of the new book, High Tech, High Touch, for their insightful remarks. We also thank our audience here in Palo Alto, as well as those listening on the radio. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, the nation's oldest and largest public affairs forum, is adjourned.
Thank you.